Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ronald Neville. I represent the appellant, Joseph Percival. Our position today is that the evidence was insufficient to prove the defendant, Joseph, guilty of bankruptcy fraud. There is no evidence, direct evidence, that Joseph ever entered into a plan or a scheme. There is no evidence that he made any false statement to the trustee. There is no evidence that Joseph knew the rules of bankruptcy, which is an important element in this case, because the crux is that the argument here is that the brother, James, was unable to disclaim his inheritance and was to transfer or notify the bankruptcy trustee that he had received an inheritance. Now, my client was never participated in the bankruptcy. My client never had anything to do with the trustee, never spoke to him, and he simply did not know the rules of bankruptcy. The expert testimony in this case is that a layperson would be unable to know the rules that apply to a disclaimer.
Why was there no motion filed for judgment of acquittal?
I can't answer that, except that I believe it should have been done, and we have argued in our case that ineffective assistance of counsel because it was not filed.
And we know that if you want to raise ineffective assistance now, you're limited to what the record.
I do know that, yes.
And no other opportunity to come back post-conviction.
I assure the court that we studied that question very carefully. I spoke to my client about it, and we decided that it was the proper course to take. One element in this case that's very important is that both Jim and Joseph, the defendants herein, spoke to an attorney. And that attorney said that Jim could disclaim his inheritance, that upon signing the disclaimer, the assets of the estate would not have to go into the bankruptcy, and all the property would be owned by my client. What the bottom line here is that my client owned all this property, and he decided to make gifts of it to his brother, who was, the record's quite clear, in terrible financial distress. And that's what this case is all about. My client simply cannot be convicted of bankruptcy fraud because there's no evidence to show that he knew any crime was being committed. We submit that at a minimum, the evidence is equiprobable, and all of these inferences that the government raises against my client can be equally reasonable inferences of innocence. And this court has held that where the evidence is equiprobable, it cannot support a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. We have, in the briefs, attempted to meet every argument the United States has made with regard to what this circumstantial evidence shows. We believe many of the arguments have no merit whatsoever, but for any arguments that this court deems do have any merit, we have to insist that the evidence generated a reasonable inference of innocence. And once that's true, once the evidence is equiprobable, you cannot support a conviction. Now, we believe that the evidence, or this issue of sufficiency, was preserved through the motion for new trial. We have to admit that the trial judge thought that the motion was that he could not be proven guilty with circumstantial evidence. But I believe if you read the final paragraphs.
Would you repeat what you just said?
I'm sorry.
Did you say the trial judge?
Trial judge, when presented with the motion for new trial, said that he thought the motion had to do with the counsel's belief that you could not be proven guilty of a crime through circumstantial evidence alone. But our argument is that if you read the final paragraphs, I think it's 8, 9, 10, and 11, that clearly the sufficiency of the evidence is preserved through those paragraphs. In Morales, this court said that a new trial must be granted if there's a strong doubt as to guilt. And certainly there's a strong doubt as to guilt here, but not so strong to require acquittal. Now, our position is that because this evidence is equiprobable, there is a strong doubt as to the guilt, and this case should be reversed, not reversed and remanded. As was brought up earlier, we have taken the position also that because no judgment of acquittal was filed, either at the end of the government's case or at the end of the entire case, that normally this court would judge the evidence on plain error. But we have raised the issue of the ineffective assistance of counsel for not filing the judgments of acquittal, and therefore you should judge the evidence based on a rational juror. We've cited many cases in our brief that deal with the equiprobable issue, and we believe it's clear that this case, at best, has equiprobable evidence, and therefore the conviction cannot stand for that reason.
Are you abandoning your other arguments?
I am not. The second issue I wanted to discuss was the aider and abettor instruction. Now, for an aider and abettor instruction, the defendant has to know that a crime is being committed, desire it to succeed, and offer some act of affirmative assistance. The evidence here demonstrates my client did not know a crime was being committed, if it was being committed. I'm not suggesting that a crime had been committed here by either of these defendants, but certainly my client had no idea what the bankruptcy rules were and had no idea a crime was being committed. Therefore, the aider and abettor instruction should never have been given. The defense counsel did object to the aider and abettor instruction. There's an argument as to whether the basis for it, but we believe that he said the aider and abettor instruction shouldn't be given. It was given, and that was error. We have also raised the issue that in the motion for new trial, defense counsel raised for the first time that the modified instruction under United States versus Ortega should have been given. And the modified instruction indicates clearly that you cannot be convicted of the crime if you have no knowledge a crime is being committed.
What about this? It was an obstruction charge against your client.
No.
My
client was charged in count one and count six. In count one was bankruptcy fraud. Count six ultimately was dismissed during the course of the trial.
That was the false statement.
Okay. Yes, sir. We have again raised the ineffective assistance of counsel. If this court were to find that the aider and abettor instruction was proper, then we believe he should have, at minimum, have submitted the modified instruction, which, when you judge all this evidence, was the more appropriate instruction to give. He did not offer that at the appropriate time. My client was severely prejudiced by that fact, and therefore that error requires reversal. As I said before, there's a lot of isolated issues in this case that have been raised by the government, saying, look at this evidence, that means that Joe Percival knew what he was doing. We tried to meet all of that in the briefs. I don't see, unless the courts have any questions of me about those particular issues, I believe that I would stand on the briefs with regard to that.
Let me ask you about the Bruton issue. Are you still contending that Bruton applies here?
Bruton, Your Honor, is the issue of my co-defendant.
All right.
It is not my issue. And that, unless the justices have any questions, that completes my argument.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Kelly.
May it please the Court. I represent Defendant Appellant James Percival. During the government's opening argument, the government described a statement that Joseph Percival, James Percival's co-defendant and brother, purportedly gave to an FBI agent. That statement...
Before you get to the Bruton problem here, tell me what is the conceivable reason why he would disavow his inheritance other than to avoid having those funds move into the bankruptcy court.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the record tells us what his exact motivation for signing the disclaimer of inheritance was. What the record does tell us is that this was a period of crisis for James Percival. He was going through a divorce. He was in bankruptcy, and his mother had just passed away. He wasn't sure how to proceed, and so he sought not one but two different counsel to ask him to advise him on how to proceed. On advice of counsel, he believed that it was okay for him to sign this disclaimer of inheritance and that doing so would legally cause all of the inheritance assets from his mother's estate to go invest in his brother Joseph.
Whether that advice was right or wrong, was anybody called to testify about that?
Neither counsel was testified. There were two counsels. There was James's bankruptcy counsel, which is Attorney Sullivan. Attorney Sullivan served as both his divorce counsel and his bankruptcy counsel. Attorney Sullivan indicated that he was planning to take the Fifth Amendment if called to the stand, so neither side called him for that reason.
So then the jury is left with a situation where, for some reason, he disclaims his inheritance. And I'm just having a hard time understanding what that reason would be other than to keep those things out of the bankruptcy court.
Based on the record, I'm not sure I can tell you other than that reason what his reason would be. What I can tell you is that he believed that signing the disclaimer of inheritance was effective. He believed that it went to Joseph, and that any property that ended up receiving was the product of Joseph's generosity, that it was gifts or loans that Joseph was giving to his brother James during a period of crisis in James's life. And that belief is directly implicated by the Bruton-violating statement that the government made during their opening argument. So the government...
Would you agree that that statement was not in evidence? There was no evidence of that in the trial. It was merely a statement at the outset of the case in opening, correct?
The statement was made twice by government attorneys during their opening statement, but it was not introduced into evidence through testimony or through any other way.
And the court gave an instruction.
The court did give a limiting instruction to the jury. However, this court has previously held that the statement of government attorneys, just an argument without any testimonial evidence being introduced, that can be sufficient to support a Bruton violation. That was this court's holding in the case of Guajardo versus Melendez. In that case, during closing argument, government attorneys described a statement that a co-defendant purportedly gave to a government agent that defendant had supplied co-defendant with narcotics.
Well, here the statement wasn't really inculpatory, was it? It was somewhat exculpatory.
In this case?
Yes.
In this case, the statement was the statement was powerfully incriminating as to James. And the government made that clear by the way that it set up the statement.
But the statement was concerning a gift, right?
Yes, the statement was Joseph saying, "I gave no gifts or loans to my brother James." The way the government provided context for this, though, was the government set forward James's case by saying, James is going to get up here. He's going to tell you, I thought the disclaimer of inheritance worked. All the property went to Joseph, and that any property I ended up receiving was gifts or loans from Joseph. Then, very next sentence, the government says, in essence, that Joseph has told the government that James is lying, that I, Joseph, gave no gifts or loans to my brother. presented in that way, it was clear to the jury at the time that the government described Joseph's purported out-of-court statement that that statement was saying, my brother's a liar, he had the fraudulent intent, it's okay to convict him. This was powerfully damaging to James's case. Joseph never testified at the trial, nor could he have been forced to testify due to his Fifth Amendment rights. For this reason, Joseph's statement violated the Sixth Amendment, and that requires a retrial under the Supreme Court's holding in the Bruton case. The government has argued that Joseph's statement is not facially incriminating, and therefore there is no Bruton violation, and there's no need for a retrial. However, this argument relies on a misinterpretation of Supreme Court Bruton jurisprudence. The phrase facially incriminating comes from the Supreme Court's holding in Richardson versus Marsh. And right in the context of that case, it becomes clear that all facially incriminating means is that it's clearly incriminating to the jury at the time of introduction.
Don't you agree that there's various degrees of Bruton problems in cases like this? For instance, if they called an agent to say, we talked to Joseph, and Joseph said, yeah, me and Jim concocted this whole thing, and we kept this money out of bankruptcy court, and we knew we were committing fraud. If they called an agent to testify to that, I mean, I can't imagine a prosecutor ever tried to do that, but if he did, there's no doubt that's a major Bruton violation.
I agree that's...
On the other hand, there may be a Bruton violation, but if there is, it's sort of on the low end of that hierarchy between the scenario I just described and what happened here.
I agree that there are different degrees of Bruton violation like you're describing. This one, I believe, is safely within the range of Bruton violations that require a new trial. The Supreme Court, in its case, Ray versus Maryland, it pointed to this problem that you're talking about. It said that the Richardson case didn't say you can't have any sort of inference, but you can't, that only non-inferential statements of co-defendants require reversal. Rather, it stated that it depends in significant part upon the kind of and not the simple fact of inference. In that case, the statement that that the defense was arguing mandated retrial was a confessional statement by the co-defendant where co-defendant says, I, co-defendant, and defendant committed this violent crime. That statement was redacted to say, I, co-defendant, and deleted, committed this violent crime, and presented to the jury that way. Supreme Court held that that statement, replacing the defendant's name with deleted, that that was close enough to require a retrial. And I submit that the amount of dots you need to connect from just the word deleted without any other information to just assuming deleted refers to defendant, that's a greater degree of inference than what we have here. Unless you have further questions, I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Love?
May it please the court. In this case, with regard to the Bruton issue, the district court did not commit error when it denied the mistrial and the motion for new trial. Defense counsel was just asked if there was anything in the record about the reason for the disclaimer, and in fact, there was evidence in the record as far as the reason for disclaimer. During defendant James Percival's testimony, he in fact stated quite clearly and unequivocally that his reason for executing the disclaimer was so that he would not have to pay or have his mother's property end up paying for his debts.
What if you did talk to a lawyer about that? Maybe it was bad advice, but a lawyer said, yeah, you can do that.
The advice of counsel instruction was given in this case, Your Honor. And James' testimony was that he sought advice of counsel with regard to whether or not he could issue a disclaimer. And assuming he did and got bad advice, that's as far as the advice would take in terms of exculpating him from his criminal responsibility. And the reason for that is that he's charged with a scheme to defraud that's designed to conceal. And 2 days before his mother's death, in response to the trustee, he advised the trustee that, in fact, if he became entitled to an inheritance, he would notify his attorney or the trustee of that. And so he admitted during cross-examination that he did not ask his counsel whether or not he still had to disclose to the trustee. He said, I assumed I didn't have to, but admitted specifically that he did not ask.
Was there an ostrich instruction tendered or given in this case?
There was an ostrich instruction tendered, Your Honor. It was declined by the court.
And I'm sorry, I didn't hear the...
And it was declined by the court. I believe that one of the questions earlier with regard to degree is exactly what we're dealing with here, and we may or may not have a degree of statement that could be a Bruton type or Sixth Amendment type error or not. Our position is that it's not. For the reason that the statement was not powerfully incriminating, and especially because it wasn't in evidence, the statement itself, my statement, that was related to the jury in the opening, does not say, first of all, it's not a confession by Joseph. So it is distanced from the Bruton case immediately. It's not facially incriminating. It does not say that James committed an act. It does not comment on James' intent. It does not comment on James' understanding of what any transfers might have been. In fact, it doesn't even say that there were any transfers. It simply denies that there were gifts or loans. It simply says what Joseph didn't do. And the reasonable inference from that right off the bat is that Joseph didn't intend to make any gifts or loans. Maybe. But I'm not sure we even know that. What we really know is he said, I didn't make any gifts or loans. I would point out that at the time in opening, when this was made, in the defense's opening, James Percival's opening, there was no reference to there having been made gifts, to gifts having been made, that was the defense. The specific language used by counsel in the opening was that Joseph allowed James to take this property. The first time that there was evidence in the case which would arguably be incriminating in light of the statements referenced in opening, even though they weren't in evidence, was when James took the stand and specifically alleged that some property was given to him by his brother as a gift. He did not allege that all property was given to him by his brother as a gift. The statement in opening would have told the jury nothing about what James was thinking. James used an antagonistic defense, if you will, with regard to whether or not he received gifts. But the statement in opening did not say that.
you want to talk about Joseph's case? That case seems to be pretty thin to me.
If I may, Your Honor.
What do you really do? He's got a brother who's in trouble with a lot of debts. And brother helping out another brother. I mean, it's not... This is kind of intricate stuff, this, what you can and can't do in a bankruptcy proceeding. And it's not like they pulled a gun out and went in and robbed the bank or something, which even Joseph would know is not permissible. But here he's helping his brother out.
In some ways, perhaps facially, that could be true.
I think it's more than facially.
Well, I would hope that... somebody in Joseph's position, this is from James' testimony, somebody in Joseph's position knew, because James testified he was there with this attorney. So this is the best case scenario for Joseph, through James's testimony, that Joseph was present when that advice was given, that he was aware that his brother intended to keep his inheritance out of his bankruptcy. In other words, he intended not to have the trustee get his mother's or the inheritance from his mother and use it to pay off James's debts. He also, and we believe the evidence gives rise to this inference, always intended that James would receive that inheritance. So yes, bankruptcy is complex in many instances, but I think that this particular aspect of it, which is really the nuts and bolts of it, isn't technical at all. The big picture in terms of, and I think this is just an overall incriminating description of what Joseph did, is that in spite of the disclaimer, Joseph either transferred or ignored or allowed James to obtain all of the inheritance that he had. And one specific piece of evidence that I would raise for the court with regard to Joseph's intent and how very greatly it bears on his intent to not use the disclaimer, that it was a sham from the beginning. And that is, Aline Percival had some savings bonds when she passed away, and they weren't owned jointly by she and either of her sons. In August of 2004, the defendants, James and Joseph Percival, went to a bank to make a claim to the Bureau of Public Debt to obtain the proceeds from those bonds. And in Government Exhibit 55, which is an application for disposition, they made that claim. The defendants, and in line with the court's question, have said, well, you know, this was just a way of letting James get his property, so we skipped a few steps. There's nothing incriminating about that. This instance that I'm describing to the court couldn't be more incriminating. In fact, in Government Exhibit 55, this application for disposition, James and Joseph together make the representation to the federal agency that they are, in fact, the sole legatees beneficiaries of Aline Percival. They say that there's a will, and they attach the will, and they list both of them as the people to whom one half of each of the proceeds should be paid. August of 2004, disclaimers in May 2003. So somewhere between August of May of 2003 and August of 2004, something happened to that disclaimer. Because in the disclaimer, James has irrevocably disclaimed his property. Irrevocably. both in this particular document, both witnesses signed, or both defendants signed before a witness under penalty of perjury. That act was a crime. It directly contradicted the disclaimer. It was a completely voluntary act.
Are you saying that Joseph knew his brother was in bankruptcy? Right?
Yes, Your Honor. James testified to that.
And Joseph knew his brother had made a representation to the trustee respecting the disclaimer?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that that's in evidence, and I honestly don't believe that is necessary, that he know of the specific disclaimer. In terms of it being a scheme to defraud, I think that his knowledge that his brother was going to use this disclaimer to keep his assets from the bankruptcy trustee, which Joseph did know. He did know that James intended to do that, when in fact James was going to take the assets. Scheme to defraud, theft, whatever the right criminal term is, it's a blatant act of crime, a blatant crime in terms of theft or fraud.
Yes, there's one of the counts here was this $240 and some laser electric. If there was nothing else, all you had in this case, would that have ever been prosecuted as a criminal violation?
I doubt very much that we would have done that, Your Honor.
Little peanut thing, right?
No. I agreed.
I'm glad you agree to that.
With regard to the Bruton issue, Your Honor, I would just go on to point out that not only were there three instructions, but one of them was tailored directly to this issue. And in view of all of the steps away from Bruton that the comment in the opening statement were, they have distanced themselves so far from the heart of Bruton, far from the heart of a Sixth Amendment matter, that certainly or surely the instruction would suffice and that a jury would not have any difficulty in following that instruction. And if the instruction were not enough, then I suggest to the court that the error was harmless. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, Your Honor, I've pointed out the big picture. I've pointed out this directly contradictory way of taking the savings bonds proceeds of their mother. We pointed out again that James had made claims on his joint tenancy stock. With regard to Joseph, further indicator of intent and going to there being sufficient evidence, James testified that he told the trustee to contact his brother Joseph. But when the trustee tried to contact Joseph, Joseph did not respond. And the trustee made two efforts, by both telephone and by letter. Admittedly, as the defense counsel says, Joseph had no legal obligation. But that doesn't mean that act is not incriminating as to Joseph. It was certainly a reasonable inference for the jury to make that his failure to do that was yet another among acts which were incriminating. As far as the equally plausible theory of innocence, Your Honor, I would suggest that there's simply no way to reconcile. First of all, I would say that to say that evidence is equipoised must be practically more than difficult, hypothetically or conceptually. But in this case, it's not a difficult call. And I would point out again to the court the bright line between the language of the disclaimer and the language of the document in Government Exhibit 55, in which James and Joseph represented that James was, in fact, still had an interest in the estate. Under those circumstances, the innocent explanation simply is not equally as plausible as a scheme to defraud existing in this case. Your Honors, if I may, I would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Just a couple of points that I'd like to make. It is the evidence is completely clear and uncontradicted that my client never knew about this conversation at the creditors' meeting, where the evidence is that Jim was told if there's a inheritance within 180 days of filing the petition, you have to notify us. There is no evidence that my client knew about that. He was there with a lawyer who told him, Mr. Hands, that Jim could sign a disclaimer. He told this to Jim as well. You can sign a disclaimer. It will keep the assets out of the bankruptcy, but Joe will own everything. What was my client supposed to do? Where's the evidence that contradicts that? We know that, as Justice said, this is difficult stuff in terms of bankruptcy disclaimers and the effects of it. Mr. Welch testified that lay people couldn't understand this unless they understood the bankruptcy code, that disclaimers are not specifically mentioned in the bankruptcy code. You'd have to know Illinois statutes, and you'd have to know the case law that dealt with those Illinois statutes. There's no evidence my client knew anything about that. And it seems to be the linchpin of the government's case, is that somehow, because he knew that the assets were not going into the bankruptcy, that was incriminating. But the evidence is a lawyer told him that, and there's no evidence that he knew what was told anything else. Everything that Joseph did was transparent. Clearly, there's a few things he did, which we called skipping some steps, but he was just attempting to give his property, to his brother. He talks about this signature where they said they were the sole legatees of the will. Well, they were the sole legatees of the will. I mean, these are lay people. They were both named in the will.
Well,
there's no evidence.
If you know that an interest has been disclaimed, why would you go out later and jointly represent that your brother had an interest?
Well, because you don't understand. It's a form. It's a document. And they're filling it out.
You're suggesting that merely because it's a document, it would have no consequence in your client's mind?
Well, my client's a flight attendant. They give him a form. It's not as though somebody sat down with him and questioned him and they went through the intricacies of it. He just filled out a form. It was transparent. I think you have to admit, if someone's trying to hide everything and they're trying to do a great plan here, that he would have taken the property and done it some other way. But as I say, throughout this entire thing, everything he did was transparent. He's not trying to hide anything. Sure, that is contradictory, but I submit to you, in the totality of this evidence, it's just one fact that doesn't carry the day for the government. He talked about not responding to the trustee's letter. The trustee said, I want you to contact me, and I may foreclose on your mother's house. He testified at trial. He had no power to foreclose on that house. He hadn't set up the proper documentation or created a lien. I'll finish with this. It created a lien against the house and couldn't do it. There's no evidence that many people do not react to lawyers that react to letters that they get from attorneys. And he could have. There's no evidence that he didn't talk to somebody who told him he can't do that. Just wait and see what happens. My time is up, so unless there's any questions, I'm...
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Kelly?
During the government's response argument, the government suggested that the statement issue here in the opening argument that Joseph gave no gifts or loans to his brother James, that wasn't talking about transactions directly, and perhaps it's not even possible to tell for sure what Joseph really did mean when he said that. I agree with the government on this point, and that goes to why this is so problematic. James did not get a chance to cross-examine Joseph to figure out what the context of the statement was, what it really meant, nor did he get a chance to cross-examine the FBI agent that this statement was purportedly made to. But this way, the government got the best of both worlds here. They, before the jury, presented this story here where they said, here's what James is going to tell you. He's going to say, I didn't have the intent. I believed that all the property I got were legitimate gifts or loans. Very next sentence is the government telling them, Joseph is saying, that's not so. I gave no gifts or loans to my brother James. In that context that the government created, it would have been clear to the jury that this statement was being introduced to show intent, fraudulent intent on the part of James. And the government's actions during the trial showed this. They brought this up in the opening minutes of the trial. It was one of the first things they told the jury about the case. And then it was the second to last paragraph of their opening argument as well. They bring it up twice. They knew it was damaging. That's why they brought it up. In the context they presented it in, it was powerfully incriminating as to James. Therefore, it is a Bruton violation that requires a retrial.
Counsel, would you just briefly address the E-Trade account?
The E-Trade account. There was insufficient evidence to show that to uphold James's conviction on the E-Trade account, because the E-Trade account never became property of James's bankruptcy estate. The E-Trade account was opened in Joseph's name, and it was opened with Joseph's money. That is a point that I don't believe the government contests. The government contests that because at trial, James testified that he had made trades on the E-Trade account, that's enough to show that it should be property of James's estate. They say that is James admitting that he controlled the account. However, the section of the bankruptcy code that determines what is and is not property of the bankruptcy estate expressly excludes from the bankruptcy estate property that is held and controlled for the benefit of another party. That's what James's testimony at trial establishes that this was. Therefore, the E-Trade account never became property of James's bankruptcy estate, and so the conviction for fraudulently concealing that as property of his bankruptcy estate must fail.
Thank you. But if that property was merely in the name of the brother, but in fact owned by the debtor, wouldn't that be property of the estate under Section 541 of the Bankruptcy Code?
If the debtor did have some sort of equitable interest in it, then it could be property of the estate. But that is not what the evidence at trial showed.
It would be property of the estate, right? Not could, would.
Would be if the debtor had an equitable interest in the E-Trade account, then yes. But the testimony at trial was not that. The testimony at trial was that he controlled it only for the benefit of his brother, Joseph.
But if all of the evidence in terms of the way the account was dealt with would demonstrate otherwise, the testimony wouldn't necessarily be the only thing you would look at to determine whether it was property of the estate, correct?
I agree the jury's entitled to evaluate all the evidence, but in this case, the only evidence tying James to the E-Trade account is that over a year after his bankruptcy, he received some money from the E-Trade account. This, too, was gifts or loans from his brother Joseph. That didn't happen until a year after the bankruptcy estate. It doesn't show that James had an equitable interest in the E-Trade account as of the filing of the petition to start the bankruptcy estate, which is the time at which you evaluate what comprises the bankruptcy estate.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.